Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Angela Alberti.
Hello, Ivy Podcast listeners. I am Angela Alberti, your presenter today and podcast host, interviewing Brad of TalentBurst. Brad, could you give us a brief introduction of yourself?
Sure. My name is Brad Talwar, and I'm founder and CEO at TalentBurst. We're a contingent workforce management company headquartered in Boston, and I co-founded the business with two other business partners of mine in July of 2002. So we're coming up on 20 years in the next 12 months.
Wow, congratulations. I'm very excited to have the opportunity to host. Like I was letting you know before we press record, I've been following you guys for some time, and it is quite a milestone to hit 20 years. So congratulations to that. I think this is gonna be the episode that we can focus on for all of those people out there that are interested on what the flexible workforce is made up on, that are interested on what the future of work can do for us, and that are interested on what's happening and how we're impacted by this process every single day. Sure. But before we do that, as a theme through all of my podcast episodes, I've initiated this, this tradition of the fire and ice questions. And I call them the fire and ice questions because it really is to put a little heat under you, Brad, but to also break the ice. We want to get to know you and who you are. So I'm just going to be asking you three questions before we get into all of the fun stuff. Number one, who do you think your greatest influence is in your life that has led you and mentored you to the person you are today?
Well, I have to say it's actually two people. One is my mom and one is my wife. And I think together they've played a very crucial role in crafting who I am. My mom gave me, you know, my work ethic as well as my drive. And my wife really kept me focused and kept me going through some of the toughest times that we as a family went through when I'd initially started the business. And even today, she keeps me really honest. And, you know, we just went through a pandemic. And as you can imagine, being a business owner, I faced many challenges March, April of last year, including basically walking around like a zombie for like 2 weeks in our house and not sleeping at night. And she really just, you know, kept me focused and kept me upbeat and, you know, got me through some of the toughest times.
Wow, that's goosebumps. I love that, Brad. And I think the whole audience can relate to some of the figures that we've had similar to that, myself included. All right, so what do you think is one of the most interesting facts about you that most people probably would not associate with Brad Talwar?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, no one would know, but when I was growing up, I was actually in boarding school, and my grandfather and father and I, we had a shared interest for stamps. Mm-hmm. And I actually have a fairly sizable mint stamp collection.
Wow.
Yeah, I think we've got between now, it's just my dad and I, but I think between the two of us, we've probably got a mint collection of over 9,000 stamps.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, it's a very classy collection hobby to have. I think I'd be super surprised if you were like, I'm a collector of Pokemon cards.
No, like definitely not. That's my son, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So if you were the CEO and co-founder at TalentBurst right now, where do you think your life would be headed, you know, outside of the career that you've grown up in? What do you think you'd be doing?
If I wasn't, right?
If you weren't, correct.
Well, here's a little known fact. You know, I grew up in India, and, you know, essentially when you're growing up in India, your parents give you three tracks. Either you be a doctor, or you be an engineer, or you're in technology, which back then was engineering because computers weren't really around in the early 90s, late 80s when I was going through high school. So I was kind of a failure because I didn't hit any of those. I ended up actually choosing accounting. And my first job was with KPMG on a track for which, if I'd stayed with it today, I would have been a CPA. Yeah. So if I wasn't the CEO of Talentburst, I would probably have been filing taxes for someone.
Wow, that's interesting. And that's so true. I mean, from a cultural perspective, I think Americans are very much heightened to focus on the liberal arts and the artistic side. Whereas we do see, you know, within the Indian community, they're very much participants of the STEM, the STEM industry as a whole. So it's interesting that you chose accounting, but little known fact, you've survived the round of fire and dice questions. Congratulations, Brad.
Well, thank you.
to the fun stuff. All righty. So just before we go into the questions, give me an idea of how you've landed into the position that you are. Where did your, I mean, you let us know that you started with KPMG, but eventually you found some way into staffing and started the Talentburst. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I'll give you the story of how I ended up in staffing. So I worked at KPMG for 6 months after I graduated college on the CPA track that I'd mentioned. And 4 months into it, my cousin, who lived at the time in San Jose, California, essentially called me up and said, listen, I'm starting a business. And I feel that if you came and worked with me and helped me get this, you know, company off the ground, you know, you could actually essentially be, let's just say, the CFO of a startup company where, you know, you would manage payroll, accounting, operations, et cetera. And I think, you know, the dot-com Silicon Valley story was just getting going in the Bay Area in mid-1996. And, you know, I found it very appealing. And frankly, I was kind of, you know, unhappy with, you know, what I was doing as a CPA. That just was not an exciting track for me. It was really boring. I was constantly back then. I mean, in India, you have to think 96. You know, computers weren't what they are today. They were very basic. Most of the work was done in like literal paper spreadsheets and, you know, huge reams of paper. And it was just not something I wanted to do. So literally the week after my 21st birthday, I hopped a flight to California. And, you know, I started working with him, and the company that we co-founded together was People.com.
Okay.
That company eventually got acquired by TMP Worldwide in December of 2000. And TMP Worldwide at the time was the parent company for Monster.com. So they were publicly traded, but 90% of the market cap at the time, which was substantial, came from the Monster.com brand. But they also had acquired 17 different businesses to form a staffing group. And I think they'd spent like over $1 billion doing this. So our company, People.com, was acquired into TMP Worldwide. And I stayed there through essentially July of 2002, at which point, you know, we had completed all our contractual obligations. We'd been through a downturn with the whole, you know, dot-com crash scenario. We'd stabilized the business. And then I exited at that time. And, you know, my two business partners, they also worked with me at People.com. And one is still my cousin. And the second is a friend of mine from high school who I had recruited into the business in operations back then. And you know, we kind of, the three of us decided that we wanted to recreate another People.com, and that's how Talentburst was born.
Wow, an interesting ride. So you've gone through many changes. It was the dot-com bust, the recession of 2008, and now the pandemic.
Yes.
What do you think is distinctive, and at least from a business owner perspective, what was distinctive about the pandemic that you didn't really experience before in the past?
Yeah. You know, it's so funny that the pandemic was just so unexpected. And a friend of mine kind of aptly called it a black swan event, where it just came out of left field. No one expected it. No one saw it coming. And it just hit us with amazing speed and impact. Mm-hmm. And that was very different than the euphoria of the dot-com or the financial crisis. We all saw what was happening with the dot-com. I mean, companies that were basically getting valuations purely on eyeballs or click-throughs or whatever back in 2000, you know, were bound to fail. And similarly, you know, you had the subprime crisis where you didn't even need to give your social security number and you could get a mortgage and go buy like 10 houses or something crazy like that. So those kind of made sense, knowing that, you know, those were failures in the economy and failures in the economic system. But a pandemic, you know, I think the last time there was a pandemic was maybe the Spanish flu like 100 years ago or something like that. I don't even know because I wasn't around. So I don't even know. But, you know, at least there hasn't been a pandemic in my parents' generation. And now, you know, I'm in my mid-40s and boom, you know, end of Feb of last year, we were actually at our highest point in terms of a revenue run rate for 2020. And then by end of March, we were actually 40% below end of Feb. So our business, our revenues dipped 40% in 4 weeks.
Goodness. So, and that's when you became a zombie.
I was a zombie during that time frame. And you know, one of our customers, they're the number one global rideshare company. Their business was basically shut down because globally no one was no one was hopping into, you know, rides from drivers. You know, it's an app-based company, and you know, that was our number one customer at the time, and it really impacted us badly. But you know, today we're in a very strong position financially as far as the company goes, as well as, you know, with our customers. And over the past 12 months we were able to replace the impact of that customer by, you know, growing revenue through other companies and adding new customers and kind of filling that void.
That's great. And what a comeback story after 40% revenue loss in 4 weeks. Gosh, yeah. I can't even imagine what that must have been like to go through. But, you know, just so that we can take it back, you know, it looks like the economy is up and things are pointing towards the right directions. And we're embarking on what could be one of the greatest rehire years. The great rehire is what I've heard it coined as. How do you think executives should pay attention to this flexible workforce? And maybe it's really defining what the flexible workforce is and the benefits that companies have in utilizing the flexible workforce.
Yeah, for sure. So firstly, the way we work has totally changed. You know, clearly the entire economy has been remote for 12 months or mostly remote. And frankly, there's no need to work in an office, which meant that locationally it's opened. Every single job is now locationally open and not restricted by commute distance. And secondly, what we've also seen, one of our business lines is global payroll, and we've seen increasing requests to hire people outside the US that can do the exact same job that someone working in, you know, Metro Houston or Metro Boston area would do. And so that's totally changed the game, because at this point, all anyone needs really is a laptop and Zoom and boom.
Yeah. And a good Wi-Fi.
And a good Wi-Fi, for sure. But outside of that, the other dramatic shift that we saw was, you know, there's been tremendous investment in healthcare and life sciences. And people have found newfound respect for what researchers in life sciences companies, pharmaceutical companies, and just healthcare companies do in general. And we feel that, or at least our prediction, as in Talentborough's management team's prediction, is that the next 10 years, the growth is going to be primarily in life sciences and healthcare. So, you know, earlier this year, we actually spun out our life sciences division from our core staffing division, and we separated out life sciences, which included pharma, healthcare, and drug discovery and medical device manufacturing customers that we had, from our technology, engineering, financial services customers, because those were all kind of blended all in one. And now we've created two separate divisions for staffing. And the life sciences and healthcare business grew over 100% over the past 12 months for us.
Goodness, wow.
Yeah, so.
Wow. And it just speaks to having that agility, that flexibility, that involvement in your business model to respond to at least what we think the direction of the market is gonna be in.
Sure, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So here's a more general question. And I love asking thought leaders this question. especially the ones that are in our geeky space of contingent work, but what, how would you define what the contingent workforce is for somebody that's completely outside of our industry and simplifying that definition?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the way the contingent workforce now, let's just say if I had a crystal ball through 2030, which is essentially this decade, is primarily going to be ruled by people sitting on a laptop with a strong Wi-Fi and Zoom. Mm-hmm. And also people really, previously it used to be the employer really had the power over the worker over the past 20, 30, 40, 50 years, right? And if you've seen Mad Men, you know, you kind of know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
But today when you've got platforms like Upwork and Fiverr, you know, and what we support with some of the app-based, you know, customers that we have, and we've got several app-based customers, you know, it's a very flexible workforce. And frankly, people can do multiple jobs at the same time. They don't necessarily need to just be doing, you know, graphic design or marketing or something. They can drive an Uber, they can work for Instacart, they can, you know, pick up service calls on Field Nation. You know, there's so many different opportunities that have opened up for them that the work week is now not just Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. It's basically 7/24/365. And you can pretty much pick what you want to do and also pick how much you want to get paid for it. So, I mean, if we follow Upwork very closely and, you know, that company, you know, has grown tremendously through the pandemic. We've also kept a close eye on Fiverr, and that's another platform that we're seeing. You know, we also have seen a couple of other light industrial type platforms, which are app-based, such as TrueBlue has, I think it's called PeopleReady or something. And we've seen the shifts, you know, dramatically increase and people getting deployed through those shifts into more warehouse, distribution, supply chain logistics type roles.
So it sounds like, you know, your definition of the contingent workforce almost is very spot on to the future of work. It's that globalization, it's that remote work setting. It's the fact that every single worker never has had more access to different forms of work and work fulfillment than they do now. And that's going to completely change the relationship that we've had with employer versus employee for the generations ahead. And that's fantastic. So Here's my next question. When it comes to these mega conglomerate tech companies, you know, the Ubers, the Indeeds, all of these companies that have once been very much tech oriented and now shifting into the staffing space or perhaps implementing a W-2 model, what's your opinion on that? And what do you think are some preparations that you would give to a company that's looking to implement some sort of presence in that space?
Yeah. So, you know, if we look at a couple of different companies in our rearview mirror, and that'll tell you exactly where I'm going with this. If you look at Walmart, and if you look at, let's just say, Sears and Kmart, they went a very different route, even though they were in the exact same industry.
Yes.
The key to the success of Walmart has been always a very forward-thinking, innovative management team. And if you look at the big tech today, as long as they continue to innovate and put their customer at the center of their business, they're going to continue to succeed. The minute you let, and I hate to use this terminology, but the minute you let the finance people start dictating where your business goes, that's the day, I call it death by spreadsheet. You're done.
So, I'm stealing that one.
So, you know, you really need to focus on the customer, where they're going, and always be nimble to figure out what the next emerging trend is. 5 years ago, I would never have thought that, you know, we would essentially go to an economy where majority of the people would be working remote, because I was looking at some stats coming into the pandemic. Only 9% of all open jobs were open for remote. And over the past 12 months, I think that number actually ticked up in the 40 to 50% range. So you can see the dramatic shift and the transformation that happens so quickly and in such a compressed time frame.
Yeah, and that's such an interesting point that you made, because there are so many more companies that are going to be open to remote.
Yeah.
And from a capacity standpoint, you're an HR department that now has to be able to act as an employer in Wyoming or know what's going on in California and properly be compliant. So what's some advice that you give to companies that are really looking to scale and offer remote work, even across the nation or even across the globe? And how do they do that successfully, compliant and statutorily okay?
Yeah, so, you know, it's kind of interesting because our fastest growing business line is the employer of record, which is essentially the W-2 payroll business that we're in. And what we're seeing is that companies are really adopting the remote work from home scenario and are jumping onto our platform in growing numbers. Previously, you know, I'll give you an example. 10 years ago, we would get requests that, hey, you know, we want to transition between 20 to 40 workers over onto your platform. Can you please payroll, you know, 20 or 40 workers? At this time, I'm getting requests of up to 10,000 and as little as 1,000 workers. I got a request yesterday that, hey, we've got 1,000 workforce population. Would you be willing to put these people on your payroll? Absolutely. And I feel like this transformation has been very, very quick. And you know, the corporate leadership is, you know, saying, okay, we know that we're not specialists in managing payroll, benefits, workers' comp insurance, you know, employee liability and stuff like that. So how about we find specialist companies such as, you know, a TalentWorks that's an EOR and an AOR and a global payroll are all combined in one, which is essentially an employment platform. And let's just hop onto this platform, because once we're on this platform, we can also access staffing from them.
Right. Absolutely. So in the simplest form, outsourcing the pedic and the liability when it comes to globalizing or even nationalizing the concept of open to remote. Now, let's go. You said agent of record, and that's commonly what we would associate to the non-W-2 category. There's a lot that's happening in this space right now, and we know that this is going to be a foreseeable path of potential change. Can you talk to me about what your opinion is on that change? What, you know, what's being done to anticipate that change?
So again, rapid transformation in the past 12 months. You know, the current administration, we're looking to see how, you know, some of the rule changes are going to come through, because, you know, it's a constantly shifting landscape when it comes to IC validation and compliance. And, you know, by the time one administration gets situated and rolls out, you know, a new set of rules and we get trained on it and start implementing them, you know, there's another set of new changes and rules that are implemented. And it's not only at the federal level, but there's also changes at the state level constantly happening. And, you know, with 50 different states, it's literally, you know, so many variables that are mixed in. But, you know, we're definitely seeing our clients, which are primarily Global 2000 companies, wanting to partner with platforms, again, like ours, to move that liability of the IC classification, whether it's accurate or not, away from them and their HR departments to third-party providers that can indemnify them and at the same time work through, you know, whether it's the ABC or the 20 factor or whatever is the current test at that time, you know?
At that place, at that time.
At that time, exactly.
Right.
To figure out what is, you know, the classification of this individual. Are they truly an IC or should they be classified as a W-2 worker?
Right, absolutely. Okay, so we're wrapping up today's session and I'm gonna lead it off with something that I'm personally passionate about, and that's just the advocacy of this type of worker. Oftentimes I've worked with enough temp workers, external workers to know that they often get treated as second class workers. And I think that notion is going to have to change because we see how competitive the market is, how feasible it is for them to attain other forms of work. What are some top of mind things that you think can be done when it comes to advocacy for this type of worker?
That's a great question. And actually what we have been doing is we recognize that, you know, we've got two different distinct workforces. You know, half our businesses, you know, IT, engineering, life sciences, and pharma, which tend to have higher pay rates, especially for the higher qualified roles. Right. And then the other half of our business, which is the EOR business, it tends to be primarily lower paid workers that might get paid between $15 an hour to $30 an hour. Right. And might be in warehousing, distribution, manufacturing, supply chain, logistics, any of those or all of those. And what we have really been doing to help them is we recognize that these people oftentimes have to work two jobs or three jobs to really make ends meet. And what we've been doing is we've been providing benchmarking data to our clients and educating them and encouraging them to actually pay these workers above market if they want to retain them. And when I say above market, let's just say minimum wage is 15 at the current moment. Now, I know for a fact that Amazon is already paying $19 and change for delivery drivers. So if some of our customers are paying, you know, 15 or 16 bucks an hour, we want to take some of that data, provide it to them and say, listen, if you want retention, you really should try and pay closer to 20 bucks an hour if you don't want a constant churn in your workforce, in your warehouse or your supply chain or wherever the case or your manufacturing facility. So we think that we're doing a great service to the worker if we can actually get them paid more so they make more money and have to work less jobs and actually spend more time with their families and taking care of their personal well-being and personal health.
Wow. And it all comes back to the data that drives behind that yeah. almost consultative, you know, approach to yeah. the clients to say, this is what's happening and this is what is going to be considered a fair livable wage, at least competitively speaking. Yeah. That's wonderful. And I think whenever I get asked that question, I always go back to fair wages. I mean, yeah. it's very simple, but if you're paying the workers fairly and perhaps giving them resources to things they didn't have, you know, maybe that's, you know, something in line with benefits or, you know, getting creative on what those added benefits could be, then you're on the right track. It's not an Einstein formulaic kind of question. It all comes down to the money, I guess.
You know, awesome. It's money, but it's really a living wage for them. And, yeah. you know, it helps them pay medical bills. It helps them put food on the table, get to work, pay rent, you know, pay their cell phone bill, which are necessities, you know, for survival. So, you know,
and there's indirect benefits to the clients as well that yeah. you know,
they have
overhead and the turnover
is less, the churn is less training, exactly.
Yeah. And it's explaining it to them in a way that shows the indirect benefit instead of the dollars that, you know.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, that's wonderful. Brad, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Angela. This has been great.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a wonderful time just getting to know you and a little bit more about what you guys do. If you guys want to get a hold of Brad, you guys can find him on LinkedIn. I know he's on there quite often. Of course, Talentverse is out there. So thank you, Brad, for the time.
Thank you, Angela. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm really honored.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.